Today's program has been brought to you by White Oak Pastures, a five-generation Georgia-based beef and poultry farm determined to conduct business in an honorable manner. For more information, visit whiteoakpastures.com.
I'm Greg Blaze, host of Cutting the Curd. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Hey, America. I'm back. I'm Chad Pagano. I'm a former Army sniper. I'm a chef instructor at the Institute of Culinary Education and an avid lifelong hunter. And you're listening to The Wild Game Domain, From the Hunt to the Hearth, airing live on heritageradionetwork.org. All right. So we had a great show last week. David Peterson, if you haven't heard it, please click on it and listen. Great interview. Great guy. Salt of the earth. Really admire him and look up to him. And we're going to have him back. I've been corresponding with him through email. So once his The Good Hunt Project, he's got a documentary coming out here soon. Once that rolls out, maybe we'll have him back in and we'll interview him again. In the meantime, at the end of last season, I believe it was, I got some feedback about, you know, last year's season, how I had done, and some of it was positive, some of it was negative. And one person, listener, I guess, enjoyed the show a lot last season, and he was interested in a show on long-range precision shooting or slash hunting. And I thought, wow, I'm surprised I never thought of that. I'm an Army sniper, for Christ's sakes. You'd think I would have thought, hey, one of my first shows should be about long-range shooting. And I put it on the back burner a little bit for the season, and here we are nice and early, and I thought, why not today? It's perfect. Perfect show to do, and I thought I have 30 minutes. I could cover that topic pretty easily. And so, you know, being the professional I am, I started looking at some notes last night after NFL football and a great Giants victory, by the way. And I thought, you know, okay, let's compress this down to 30 minutes. And then, you know, about 2 hours into writing out the show, I decided that's nearly impossible for me. You know, my passion and my love of this subject matter does not allow me to compress it into a 30-minute show. So we may go a few minutes longer today, but we certainly will have to do a follow-up show and continue this subject, because when I was in, I think, kindergarten, they taught me you start at the beginning. That's the American way. You just start right at the beginning. It's the best way to do things. And the beginning of long-range or appreciating long-range shooting is through knowing the history of it and appreciating the history of it and where it comes from, where we come from, the modern shooter. And so that takes a while to really appreciate that. You know, my story starts, you know, I guess in sniper school for me, for the most part, but I grew up hunting and shooting, and my father had a .22 in my hand when I was, I don't know, probably 7-6 years old. I was shooting .22 and you know, through iron sights and at 25 yards, hitting the can and then backing off, and eventually 50 and 100, I was shooting squirrels with a .22 at 100 yards. And I just learned, you know, through my father's teaching, the breathing techniques, the way of handling the firearm, you know, your momentary tendencies that we have when we're about to squeeze the trigger. All of these things, you know, play into long range shooting. It never really hit home. So, you know, from there, I hunted for years. I eventually joined the Army, ended up in sniper school, started learning the ballistics and the mathematical calculations necessary to shoot at long range. From there, you know, I got out of the military and I was on my first hunt. I still remember this. I was on my first hunt after leaving the military, and I was walking with a friend to his hunting spot, and he said, all right, we're going to walk up this logging road, and I'm going to put you by the rock, and then I'll go out and walk around, see if I could stir something up for you. And we took about three steps up this logging road, and it was almost, you know, straight up this hill, and we're in the Adirondack Mountains. And I don't know, the hill was probably 300 yards to the top of the hill from where we were. And we took gravel, noisy, you know, and I took one step on the gravel and kind of the gravel crunched. And I looked up and there was a buck, or what appeared to be a buck, standing 300 yards on top of this hilltop right in the middle of the logging road. And so I kneeled down instinctively, and my friend moved to the side of the logging road, the left side. I moved to the right side, and we're kind of in the thick grass. And he looks at me and he says, okay, here's what we're going to do. You're going to stalk up on the right. Go nice and easy. I'll stay put. Once you stop, go up about 30 yards. Stop. I'll move up. And I was thinking to myself, okay, that's a good plan. I said, wait a second. Why don't I just shoot it from here? And I stepped out into the logging road, took a good shooter's position, kneeling position, and I fired a round, and I dropped the deer in its tracks, you know, at approximately 300 yards uphill. And my friend started hooting and hollering and hugging me, and he couldn't believe, how'd you learn to shoot like that? That was an amazing shot. Incredible. And I was thinking to myself, is he kidding me? That was a chip shot for an Army sniper. Really, any military trained marksman could have made that shot. Especially with a, you know, 30-06 Remington Woodmaster, I think I was using at the time, a semi-automatic, you know, not the most accurate rifle, but certainly able to hit a target at 300 yards with a 165 grain bullet. You know, I love Remington, not to sell them, but the Remington Core-Lokt, 165 grains, not even a big bullet, you know, per se. And that's what got me thinking about archery at that moment. I said, you know what? This is kind of boring. So that's when I started picking up bow and arrow and decided to get into hunting. So for me personally, I mean, if you called me and said, hey, we're going to Wyoming and we're going to hunt, I don't know, mule deer or antelope, elk, whitetail out on the you know, eastern Montana plains and the ridges and the mountains of Montana, I would do it. I don't know how fun that would be for me. My idea of a challenging hunt is to get up and real personal with the wild animals, with the wild game. But there is certainly a challenge, and I wouldn't disparage anybody who took the challenge of making a 300-500 yard shot on a mule deer from a rocky outcropping somewhere in Montana. But again, there's a lot of skill set and a lot of practice that has to go into making that shot in the elements, in the wind, in the rain, in the relative humidity, in all the factors that are gonna put drag, what we call drag, on that bullet as it travels further and further away from your firearm. So started writing a show, and here we are. So, you know, I said, all right, you know, long range. Let's think about that for a second. What is long range? And, you know, I guess that's, by definition, relative or subjective. You know, what's long range? Long range for me, you know, at sniper school, we had to shoot 1,000 yards. That was long. That was not an easy shot to take, even in a perfect situation. Some of you guys who are going to be, or women who are going to be new to long range shooting, you know, don't start at 1,000 yards. We're going to start 200 yards. And that's a relatively long range shot for certain people. But, you know, when the earliest European settlers arrived here, you know, really on the East Coast here in Brooklyn, I think they landed, you know, they were armed with a collection or a ragtag pile of different kinds of firearms. And to be honest with you, you know, maybe they had what we call match or wheel locks, and we'll get into this stuff, all different kinds of firearms. And really, these firearms were more dangerous to the user in a lot of ways than the intended victim, whether that be an animal or another human. So, you know, and the problem was the immigrants, the people that were escaping persecution and coming to this new world, they were, you know, to put it lightly, the dregs of the British society. They weren't allowed to have good firearms. You know, if they had them, really, it was illegal at the time. And they weren't allowed to hunt in England. That was only for the aristocrats, you know. So these people didn't have a lot of training, you know, and we know the names. You guys all went to hopefully decent schools and learned about Captain John Smith and in the Virginias and good old Captain Miles Standish, Plymouth Colony. You know, and we look back at these guys, obviously great Americans. They founded this land, but they settled it. But they weren't great shots at the time, you know. But they got here and they decided, wow, this is a really important tool that I have to use here. Most of them were not soldiers, didn't have any kind of military background training. And so they might have impressed the Native Americans with this big explosion, with the sound, you know, and the flame and the rolling smoke and the whole big thing. But it really, they were really not very accurate with these firearms. In the early days, you know, long range for these kinds of firearms meant 50 yards. You know, that was a great shot. You know, so there was this, you know, we look back at it and we skip a large portion of history when we go right to the idea that, you know, the American settler, the American boy could shoot out a mosquito's eye or a gnat's eye at 100 paces, you know, and all these stories. They were missing everything in the beginning, you know. You know, and at this time, remember, Native Americans were harvesting wild game, you know, with bow and arrow, with spears, with other primitive weapons for a really long time. They didn't have modern firearms. So as time passed, gunsmiths from Europe immigrated here. They were escaping the tyranny, and they came up and they came to the New World, and they set up shop, and they brought their tradition of fine manufacturing and the knowledge that was necessary, the technical knowledge that was necessary to build weapons that could shoot at long distance, and they fit this kind of manufacturing into the realities of the colonies. What could people afford? What could people pay me for this weapon? They were businessmen. And, you know, the somewhat, I guess you would call them clumsy, or, you know, rifles of larger caliber that were found in Germany and Austria and Switzerland really went under a huge amount of change here in the New World. And it all started really in Pennsylvania, the Lancaster area of Pennsylvania in the early 1700s. These French, Swiss, German, really craftsmen were the first Americans to make rifles that were manufactured in a smaller caliber. So, you know, they were lighter, they needed less metal. So this was all, you know, based on the terrain, the economic considerations of the colonies and what these colonists needed. The sphere, the calibers went from, you know, 50 caliber, even larger, to 32 caliber, to 45 caliber. And the bullets weighed, you know, anywhere from 140 to 160 grains. This was very small in comparison to what they were using in Europe. They were using 60 to 70 grains of powder, very small charge. And we'll get into that later. In comparison, again, to what they were using in Europe. So this helped in a lot of ways. It helped with drag on the bullet. They were able to be more accurate with the smaller calibers. They had a faster bullet. They had a lighter weapon to handle. All of these things kind of led to better shooting technique. They also, at the same time, extended the barrel. They made the barrel of this rifle, of the rifles, longer, about 40 inches, and this increased the velocity and made the, you know, ball and powder very, very accurate. It also made it a more quiet firearm, and the rifle was equipped with more reliable ignition systems. This is about when something called the flintlock became available to people. And, you know, before then, really, even war was kind of a joke, you know, in certain ways. It would rain. All right, everyone pack up for the day. We're not going to fight today because all our powder is wet and the weapons barely fire. So the idea of flintlock came about, and this really helped. So it has what we call furniture, the parts, the moving parts of a rifle, the brass furniture, and a recess, basically a hole built in to the butt of the rifle to hold a supply of grease or ungreased patches. They had a patch box, and this was really a new idea and a distinguishing feature of what eventually became known as the Kentucky rifle. It provided a small, sometimes metal, iron, or in nicer rifles, a brass blade front sight, hickory wood ramrod, you know, just a beautiful, beautiful piece of art. It was pleasing to the eye. It was a joy to carry, and it was a good weapon for the time to use in the heavy forest that these men were operating in. A distinct disadvantage of this rifle, opposed to, you know, smooth bore muskets, was that loading was slow and required a short metal rod and mallet, and so this really all had to change for the American, what we're going to call the marksman now, because now with the Kentucky rifle, you know, he had a tool, a firearm that was capable of ranges out to 300 yards. You know, he could actually hit something at 300 yards. He was deadly accurate. The frontiermen were deadly accurate out to 100 yards. That was a chip shot for them with this new rifle. The technologies kept advancing, moving forward. So a good shooting rifle, handmade by a Pennsylvania craftsman, might cost a man, you know, a half a year's wages. And that seems like a lot to us. But at the time, you know, they were putting it away. They were living off the land, and they would buy one of these rifles, and it was an investment in their future. And to this day, you know, me and a lot of firearm enthusiasts still call the rifle a tool. The rifle is a tool that we use to harvest animals for the most part. You know, it was remarkably precise, and it gave them distance. Oddly enough, the rifle seemed to be almost solely a development of this Pennsylvania area, and you know, somehow it took on the word Kentucky rifle and all this business. But this was the area where it started, and then you start hearing now we're starting to get into the legend of it, and this is when we have guys like Daniel Boone, Davy Crockett, the great frontiersmen of the time, coming into the picture as we move forward. And then, you know, this rifle played a big part in the forming of our actual country, not just settling the frontier. You know, because of this rifle, it allowed survival of the frontiersmen, of the settlers, of all the settlements for that matter. You know, a hunting team of four men could go out for a week and bring home enough food for at least a week, hopefully 2 weeks, with these new precision rifles. And they would come home with rabbits, bear, of course, white-tailed deer. So, you know, it became a mechanism of survival for these frontiersmen and the settlements in general. And I can't believe it's 18 minutes after 10 o'clock already. So with that, we're going to take a short break here. You are listening to the Wild Game Domain on HeritageRadioNetwork.org. Cruise.
White Oak Pastures is the only farm in the United States that has its own USDA-inspected red meat abattoir or slaughterhouse and its own USDA-inspected poultry abattoir or slaughterhouse. We partner with Whole Foods to deliver our high-quality meat and poultry from Miami, Florida, all the way to Princeton, New Jersey. One family, one farm, five generations, 145 years. A full circle return to sustainable land stewardship and humane animal stockmanship. For more information, please visit our website, whiteoakpastures.com.
We're thrilled to announce a special event, the Silver Snail 25 Years of Slow Food. This event is hosted by Slow Food USA, Heritage Radio Network, and Roberta's Pizza. It's been 25 years since Carlo Petrini and a group of activists launched a peaceful revolution to defend regional traditions, good food, gastronomic pleasure, and the slow pace of life. The slow food movement has since evolved into a comprehensive approach to food that recognizes strong connections between plate, planet, people, politics, and culture. Today, this movement involves thousands of projects and millions of people in more than 160 countries worldwide. Join us for a dialogue between Slow Food's founder, Carlo Petrini, and locavore activist, Alice Waters, as they reflect on the evolution of the food movement and all things slow. Friday, October 3rd from 11:30 to 2:30. You can go to our website and click on the link on the right-hand side of the page to RSVP. We can't wait to see you there.
Hey, welcome back to the Wild Game Domain on Heritage Radio Network. I am Chad Pagano. We're talking about long-range shooting here. So now here's where it gets interesting. All right, so we got to Daniel Boone and these guys. So the rifle really gained its fame, the name, from its use in what the Native Americans called, and this is all very romantic and kind of cool, but the dark and bloody ground, the land west of the Allegheny Mountains. And this area was populated by the Iroquois and the Cherokee. And it was, you know, in this area, it was just a continuous state of warfare between the tribes. And they say the ground was stained dark by the bloodshed in battle between these two tribes for possession of this area. And why would they care about this area? Well, it was the rich hunting grounds. This was where the animals were. It was fertile land. It was what the Indians needed to survive, or what the Native Americans needed to survive. So in the years leading up to the Revolutionary War, which we're going to get to, frontiersmen thought, you know, this region was a hunter's paradise, which it really was. So these frontiersmen traveled the Ohio River, you know, talking about the valley, the beauty of it, the abundance of game, the water, everything that came along with it. So this is where Daniel Boone comes into the history books, you know, skilled marksman, frontiersman. He explored the passage known as the Cumberland Gap. And he had that rifle in hand, and he traveled all the way, you know, into Kentucky. So Boone's rifle is more correctly called the Pennsylvania rifle, in my opinion. You know, people started calling it because of Daniel Boone, the Kentucky rifle. But it became permanent. It became permanently known as the Kentucky rifle on January 8th, 1815. This was 2 weeks after the Peace of Christmas Eve, and the War of 1812 was already over when 5,000 American soldiers and militiamen, including 2,000 Kentucky and Tennessee frontiersmen armed with these long-barreled rifles, fell under the command of a man called General Andrew Jackson and engaged 7,500 British troops. In battle along they battled along a drainage canal just south of New Orleans. The British forces, in their proud tradition of warfare, were advancing in their columns into American cannon fire, and these orderly lines of troops, as these orderly lines of troops came into the rifle range of these frontiermen, you know, so within 300 yards, you know, anywhere between 100 and 300 yards, Andrew Jackson decided, you know what, forget the cannons. Let's show them what Americans are made of. So they ended the cannon fire, and they lifted the cannon fire. So there wasn't as much smoke on the battlefield anymore. And now, you know, the frontiersmen could see the redcoats coming across the drainage ditch, and the American riflemen were hidden in trenches, behind cotton bales, behind trees. And they just started taking their shots, and they took down 2,000 British soldiers in that battle, just because of their skill set and the accuracy of these Kentucky / Pennsylvania rifles. So the Battle of New Orleans, it really raised this idea about the rifle and what was possible with this. It was not the first conflict on American soil where we saw its long range capabilities, but it really brought forward how accurate this rifle could be. Going back from there into the American Revolution is where we really started to see it through the formation of new ways to fight wars. The Americans, as we know, the militiamen, they in the early parts of the American Revolution would hide behind trees and rocks and take shots at British soldiers. And there were so many stories in history that say, the British were out on the field of battle and they knew through their scouts and their reconnaissance of the battlefield, they knew where the Americans were, and they were not worried about Americans hitting them or having the range to hit them at that point in their camps or in their operation area leading to battle. And so many stories of generals falling from their horses at that point. The rifle is what really turned the tide. So, in July of 1775, George Washington, the great George Washington, found himself in command of the Continental Army. And he had within that 10 companies of riflemen. Captain Morgan, read about Captain Morgan, a Virginian. He was in command of these rifle companies. And as proof of their capabilities, the Virginians marched from Winchester, Virginia, to Boston, 300 miles away in just 3 weeks. And New England was treated to displays of marksmanship that amazed the locals who were unfamiliar with the rifle. Morgan's men, really frontiersmen, would demonstrate, hitting targets at twice the maximum range of what they were using, in England and up north. And that was a pretty amazing thing. And over the next couple of years, Morgan would command troops under Benedict Arnold. He would go to Quebec, the Hudson River Valley. And some of the lessons he learned, as good as that rifle was, it was still slower than the musket. And riflemen could not engage enemy without support. Morgan's riflemen would prove, that they could win battles or prove their worth, and basically these guys were snipers at the Battle of Saratoga, where they called them back then in the early stages skirmishers, going out in front of the main battle lines to use their skills with the rifle. And they would, not dissimilar to modern sniper teams, go after high value targets, disable gun crews, kill officers, and generally just slow and harass the enemy's movement. So this, let's call it something romantic, a constant rain of accurate long range rifle fire hampered the fighting efficiency and the morale, really, of the British troops. In the field of battle, these guys are like, oh, we can't even get to the enemy without taking bullets to the head, to the torso. It was horrific for these British soldiers. And it really brought down morale. And it was here that one of the most, and I learned about this shot in sniper school, is one of the most famous long-range shots of the American Revolution. And the most celebrated of Morgan's riflemen was actually a man from Pennsylvania named Tim Murphy. And the history books say, or the I don't know if it's actual history, the myth of this says that Murphy was ordered to kill a British officer astride a gray horse perched in a tree. He steadied his firearm on a strong limb, and he missed with his first shot. So he, you know, reloaded, got ready, and with his second shot, he mortally wounded a top general at this battle. And again, it was a range of 300 yards. The next, he reloaded, and he next, you know, he drew a bead on another general and hit him, and they say it was not a great shot. I think he hit him in the lower abdomen or something, and but eventually this general, you know, was out of battle and eventually passed. So this really set the standards and set the war. And, you know, after the war was won, the rifle just continued to prove its worth as a new nation just kept pushing westward. And as a tool, I love that. I love calling rifle a tool. It both protected, it fed, it provided security. Without the rifle, this country would not have been born. On the occasional holiday, it provided entertainment to the men, the riflemen. You know, the idea of turkey shoots or what they would call beef shoots. You know, these tournaments or matches were fired standing or from a rest at 100 yards or so. And the targets might have been an X, you know, drawn on a piece of wood, a fire-blackened piece of wood from a campfire, or on a blazed tree side, or a trussed turkey partially hidden behind a downed log. You know, they tried to make it as challenging as they could. You know, and as this bird's head would bob up and down, the frontiersmen took turns trying to hit the moving mark. A successful shot earned the marksman the unlucky bird. You know, he got to keep the bird, nice turkey. If the prize were beef, then it might well be awarded in, you know, quarters of the cow or parts of the cow, the best cuts of the cow. You know, so you know, looking back, the Revolutionary War, the War of 1812, hinted or gave us the idea that the rifle was the firearm of the future. You know, slow rate of fire, all those things, but it had won these wars for us. The new nation at that point decided, all right, there's no denying this. You know, back then there was no denying that the firearm was a tool. It was something necessary to the American people and the public. And companies started springing up. And this is where a company was started in Springfield, Massachusetts. The other company was started in Harper's Ferry, Virginia. And these companies, which we'll get more into, produced both muskets and rifles for the Army. Harper's Ferry produced about 20,000, I think it was, or 25,000 model 1803 U.S. flintlock rifles. And then within that design, contractors or private contractors manufactured the model 1817 U.S. flintlock rifle. And they referred to these tools as the common rifle. And they became a staple in American society. As the nation moved westward, the rifle would begin to replace all of the smoothbore muskets that were left. The technology's advance would bring, you know, the idea of, which we talked about in the beginning of the show, the idea of long-range shooting beyond 300 yards at this point. And guys were shooting, you know, at further and further distances. And at this point in the history of shooting, we decided it was time to improve the bullet. The round ball, you know, had a limited efficiency at best. You know, it was small. It didn't have a great, just based on its shape, ability to engage the rifling of the barrel. So, you know, new ideas, you know, the idea of a cylinder made with soft lead was starting to be tested. And when fired, you know, with a lot of force behind it, was capable of amazing accuracy based on the spin that was created by the rifling, a very quick spin, which cut through the atmosphere, which cut through the air, making for a more accurate rifle. The new bullet was capable of flying further than a traditional ball. So again, ranges were increased. The new bullet was adopted for war by Jefferson Davis, and he ordered all Springfield muskets returned to the armories to have their barrels rifled in a certain way to allow for this new technology of bullets. As the rifle developed, the recreational use of firearms also progressed. So, we're getting into the beginning now of the 19th century. Some gunsmiths had already begun to produce rifles specifically for these competitions that were springing up. And these flintlocks were heavy. They had barrels of 38 to 45 inches in length, had full stocks, double set triggers. The advancements in all of the equipment really started to take shape. What happened at this point, if we look to modern technology, we're under the assumption as modern men that, we have the best technology today, and we do. We have optical scopes, range finders, all of these things that aid us in long range shooting. But the truth of the matter is, the telescopic sight, for a long part of American history was thought of as a hindrance to shooting. It was thought to take away from the art of shooting or the skill set of shooting. Eventually, guys started shooting out to 800 yards. The optical sight came into use. Bullets started to become bigger again, and with the different kinds of sights, metallic leaf sights, at this time, advancements in optics were allowing us to shoot out to 1,200 yards. We were starting to see these longer and longer distance. The South was still employing sharpshooters in small independent teams. The North at the time took a more traditional approach. As far as using innovative equipment. So you might find guys with optical scopes up north, but down south, they were sticking to this tradition of open sights, pin sights, all these new kinds of technologies, even for the men down south were coming into play. So this is where, formal training kind of started falling into place within the military. We decided, we got to start training everyone in the same standard. And that's really when we decided, we have a real skill set here. We had surpassed the Europeans in shooting technologies. We had already surpassed the Europeans in technique, in how we manufactured the weapons. And this led to, the modern shooter out on the plain, the ability to shoot animals at long distance, changes in technique for our military were now coming into play, where we were setting up, standard operating procedures for the military. And I just looked up because I was in a zone there for a while. It's 10:37. Here in Brooklyn, New York. All right, we're going to pick this up. And when we get, I could have went on and on for two more hours, but we're going to stop here. You know why? Because my time is up. When we come back next week, we're going to get into the nuts and bolts of long-range shooting. We're going to talk about the techniques necessary. We're going to get into the ballistics of it. We're going to get into the actual skill set of shooting at distances over, 300, 400, 500 yards. And we're going to put a practical spin on how we apply that to our hunts. You know, really here in New York, you know, across this great nation. So that's all the time we have. You've been listening to the Wild Game Domain on heritageradionetwork.org. We'll see you guys next week.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archive programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions anytime at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a 501c3 nonprofit. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.